I have some more material I wanted to hand out. There's a one-page handout that's just a very brief historical perspective on the American Psychiatric Association's ECT Task Force. And here I have got copies of the statutes on reporting for Illinois and Colorado, two of them. For you, for those who don't know who I am, I'm the director of the National Organization of Persons Who Had ECT called Committee for Truth in Psychiatry. And I want to be a resource for you after this meeting, and I'm going to pass around my card so people have questions that don't get answered can know how to get in touch with me as this process goes on. I had asked for 20 minutes to talk. I know people are going over, so please be patient if I go over a bit. I asked for 20 minutes because I had asked to testify previously in the legislature, and I had been turned down twice, so I didn't want to ask for too much and get turned down again. So I'll try to be brief. I've been following the progress of H-12 since inception, maybe 3 years ago. I have reviewed all the drafts. I've listened to all the tapes of all the meetings that were taped. And just as I would follow any kind of legislation or regulation of ECT in any other state, because the Committee for Truth in Psychiatry was organized and still is organized for one purpose, which is to advocate for truthful, informed consent to ECT. And along those lines, we have been active in many states and at the federal level whenever something like this comes up. Our name, Committee for Truth in Psychiatry, reflects the fact that our purpose is to advocate for truthful, informed consent. We have no other purpose, and that we were organized in 1984. I became active in 1985. We've got 500 members around the country, and I've been the director since 1992. I am an ECT survivor, and all of the members of our group had ECT without informed consent. We experienced permanent memory loss, and we were not informed of the memory loss. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that what happened to us doesn't happen to other people. So I want to address just the most important issues from our point of view, which is the adequacy on the information of permanent memory loss and permanent adverse effects, and the information about rehabilitation that's contained in the proposed Vermont consent forms, which we've reviewed. What do we know, and what can patients be told about the extent of permanent memory loss and permanent cognitive disability, the extent and prevalence, and who decides what we know about these things? Is it really true that there is not enough research, as has been claimed? And the answer to that question is both yes and no. There has been extensive research in which people attempted to quantify, document, and look into the extent and nature of ECT memory loss. And many of these studies are referenced in the handout I gave you, ECT as head injury, in the bibliography there. So I'll just talk about a few of them. I think Dr. Bragan talked about the Janus study, Irving Janus, which was the best study that was ever done, where he elicited narrative information from people about their lives prior to ECT, and then tried to elicit the same information from them right after ECT, 6 months later and a year later. And what he found was extensive personal memory was not accessible to these people as far as a year after ECT. And if you read the study, it's very good because the people speak in their own words and you can read their own words. It's not like a checklist or a questionnaire where a doctor decided what would be important for patients to remember. It's what they really did remember and then what they no longer remembered. Larry Squire is a memory researcher who's been researching ECT. He uses ECT patients as his subjects. His real subject of research is memory, and he uses ECT because ECT causes amnesia. He looked at people 3 years after, which is the longest that anybody has looked at people after ECT, and he found 3 years later the majority of people still had impaired memory. He tried to estimate the amount of lost memory, and he estimated 27 months to be the average. Freeman is a British psychiatrist. Freeman and Weeks did studies. One of their studies was looking at people with neuropsychological testing, people who had complained of cognitive impairment. And what he found is actually the opposite of what Sackheim says he found. If you saw the Sackheim editorial, actually, he miscites the study. What it does show is that these people had cognitive impairment that was due to EC and could not be attributed to drugs and memory loss, though they did try to attribute it to drugs, to drugs and psychiatric illness. There's a guy named Donald Templer who's also done research, and he writes about ECT in his book, which is called Preventable Brain Damage. Those are just some of the references. So these studies do exist. It's not that they don't exist, but they haven't been cited in the APA Task Force report, and they have been ignored, for example, in the Surgeon General's report. The Surgeon General only looked at research from about the past 15 years. When I talked to the drafters of that report, they had never heard of the Janus study or the Squire studies. And the drafter of that report cited himself 15 times as a source. Dr. Matthew Rudorfer was a drafter of that report, and he is an ECT proponent. So we have the research, but it's often ignored. And the other thing that's happened is since about the early to mid 80s, the research has become dominated by the members of the APA ECT Task Force, their colleagues, and their students, all of whom have a career interest and many of whom have a financial interest in promoting ECT and in the companies that make the shock machines. Now, just a couple of examples would be Dr. Richard Weiner and his team at Duke University. He's the head of the APA Task Force. He is an electrical engineer who helps design shock machines, and he is a consultant to shock machine companies. Dr. Harold Sackheim, also a task force member, has admitted receiving tens of thousands of dollars from shock machine companies. Federal law on research limits the amount of money that people can get to $10,000 before a conflict of interest issue is raised. These two men in particular have received millions of NIMH dollars over the past 20 years. Sackheim's a little less than 20, Weiner's a little more than 20 years. And so what do we know after 20 years? These men have gotten grants with titles like Long-Term Effects of ECT, Affective and Cognitive Consequences of ECT. But in fact, the research has evolved away from basic unanswered questions to arcane technical questions that have not benefited patients one bit. There has never been a before and after brain scan study done by people outside the ECT industry. In fact, in 1990, Dr. Sackheim stated flatly that such a study would never be done by anyone outside of the ECT industry. And he also said at that time he was not interested in studying persons with permanent memory loss, which could not be attributed to drugs and mental illness. If there is not enough research, it is not an accident. It is a political decision. And in my opinion, it's a political decision that is not likely to reverse itself. But to say that there is not enough research being done with federal grant money, which funds about 90% of the research on mental health in this country. To say that there is not enough research and there may never be enough research done by NIMH is not to say that we don't know enough to tell people about what happens with permanent memory loss and cognitive disability. We know, and we can be telling people, that amnesia for months and years is common, and we know about the nature of cognitive deficits, and we know that they do not resolve. How do we know this? Well, there's many ways. One of the ways is through the files of the Food and Drug Administration. I gave you a handout of excerpts from FDA letters where I explained briefly that the Food and Drug Administration became responsible for regulating ECT machines in 1976. In 1979, they classified the ECT device in a class 3 of the three possible categories. Now, class 3 is the high-risk category. It means that risks have not been shown to outweigh benefits. And the risks that were identified by FDA at that time were brain damage and memory loss. And to this day, ECT remains in class 3 at the FDA. A class 3 rating was supposed to trigger by federal law, a safety investigation of the device. In fact, this has never happened. And the reason this has never happened is because the APA got very involved and petitioned the FDA to reclassify the device to class 2 without a safety investigation. Dr. Richard Weiner, who I just mentioned, the head of the task force, organized a lobbying campaign, tried to get everybody from the APA to write in and say to the FDA, do not investigate this device. We'll tell you it's safe. You take our word for it. The manufacturer of the devices have never submitted one single safety study to this day or a shred of evidence that their devices are safe. At the same time, survivors of ECT, the general public, concerned citizens, and every single PNA in the country wrote to the FDA and called on them to do the safety investigation that the APA was lobbying against. Besides calling for a safety investigation, or along with calling a safety investigation, the majority of survivor letters contain information regarding to the long-term effects of ECT on memory and on cognition. They describe the nature, extent, and longevity of memory and cognitive effects. And some of those letters, a few of them were included in what I just passed out. Some of them Jennifer has, and there were too many to Xerox, but I've got sets of them if people want to see them. I have been to the FDA, and I have looked through the files and read everything there. I estimate there's about 1,000 survivor letters. And they describe memory loss that does not just last for the time of the treatment, that can last for years. They describe cognitive disability that affects the person's ability to return to their life and their work. And they implore the FDA to carry out a safety investigation based on their own experience. There are exactly 14 letters, which I have Xeroxed, and a couple are in that pile, of people who had ECT, wrote to the FDA, and said basically, you know, ECT was okay. For me, some of these people talk about memory loss, and some of them don't. So the letters from people who had ECT, who were in favor of ECT, are a very small minority, 14 letters versus approximately 1,000 letters from people who describe permanent adverse effects on their memories and their cognition and their lives. Now, this is the largest public database of ECT's adverse effects that we have. And it is not a research study. It was not meant to be a research study, but it is information from which we can extrapolate about the nature and prevalence of memory deficits. There are also in the FDA files some neuropsychological reports that ECT survivors have had done at their own expense to find out what happened to their brain and also to share with other people. And I am one of the people who have had this testing done. Neuropsychological testing is designed to detect brain damage when there is no before study to go by because you can't predict that you're going to have brain damage. So there are a few of these in the FDA files. I've seen about 15 of them. And the striking thing of the neuropsychological reports is that they're very much the same. When people lose intelligence points, they lose a significant amount of intelligence, not a small amount, and it tends to be the same. People do badly on the same kinds of testing. People have deficits in the same kinds of things, which we can identify using the language of these reports, things like executive functioning, analytical thinking, abstract reasoning, organization, all those good things of higher level mental function that make it possible for anybody to get anything done. There is also an extensive literature on memory loss over the years that is published and unpublished ever since ECT has been given in books, newspapers, and journals, in the records of public hearings, whenever public hearings have been held and survivors have testified. The testimony is all about memory loss. The public hearings were held at the FDA. There were New York public hearings. There are Texas public hearings, San Francisco hearings. And what you find is when survivors come forward, survivors are talking about long-term adverse effects and what they wish they had been told. There are published accounts from the 1940s through the 1970s. In 1973, there was an article in the New Yorker that became very well known about Marilyn Rice, who founded our group, Committee for Truth in Psychiatry. and right through to June 2000 with Ann Donahue's account and the Washington Post account. It's the same story over and over. The stories have not changed that people are talking about. They have this memory loss. It's devastated their lives, and they were not told about it. The pattern of the memory loss has not changed. If you're under the impression that at some point ACT was changed or modified and is better now than it was at some unspecified point in the past, you should know those claims have been made since the 1950s when they were saying it was better than the 40s. And you should look at Doug Cameron's article, which I gave you in the packet, which debunks those myths. It is not true. It is not better. They don't know how to do it now. And people are still having the same effects. As a shock survivor and director of Committee for Truth in Psychiatry, I've been listening to and learning from ECT survivors for 15 years now. And I could tell you, if I thought for a minute that I was an outlier, a rare case, or a 1 in 1,000 or a 1 in 200 case of having lost 5 years of my memory and 38 points of my IQ, I would not be doing the work that I'm doing. But in fact, every week I get phone calls and letters and new information, and I keep meeting people at conferences, or people seek us out and find us, and everybody tells the same story. Everybody thinks they're the only person that this ever happened to. I had memory loss. My doctor said it would come back. It didn't come back. Well, guess what? When you start networking with other people and sharing, then you realize, you know, you aren't the only person, that this is happening systematically. And I have to say, CTIP as an organization has no money. I make no money. We have no outreach. We have no advertising. We have no website. But people reach us to such an extent that I have to wonder, you know, what would happen if we did have money for outreach. And I cannot believe that every single person who had ECT and has permanent memory loss is somehow getting to CTIP, because that would be impossible. What we learn when we share our experiences is we learn about the nature and the extent of memory loss. I know this by living it, and I hear this from other people. Memory loss is not something, the kind of memory loss you have with ECT is not something you can prepare for. It's not something you can be coached on. It's not something you can relearn. It's not a laundry list of events or things that somebody can give you and then, you know, everything is okay. That makes sense, because memory is everything that goes into your mind during the time that's wiped out. It's not just for events. It's for learning. It's for your job skills, your relationships, your thinking, what you thought, what your emotions were, what you wrote. All of those things are part of memory. And you cannot... you cannot prepare for this. You cannot get it back. You can't compensate for it. You know, you can have somebody come up to you and say, "Hi, I'm your boyfriend, and you've never seen this person in your life." Well, that doesn't get you back that relationship that you had with that person. You can't get that back. That cannot be fixed. So I think the part about preparations for memory loss trivializes the kind of memory loss and in no way prepares people for what to expect after ECT. In recent years, survivors have been working on designing and implementing our own research. You had the Julie Lawrence study cited by CMHS was in your packet. This was 1996, and she asked people questions about long-term effects and also effects on depression. 83% had long-term memory loss. They started a study in March of 99. Over 200 people responded, and they're still responding. And they asked about cognitive impairment as well as amnesia. They found 82% had permanent amnesia, 81% impaired memory ability, 85% impaired concentration, 60% impaired language and writing skills. And they found, as Julie did, that about 73 to 75% of people reported that at the same time ACT had had no effect on their depression. I designed a survey for CTIP of our members where I asked about cognitive deficits. And I modified a questionnaire used in brain injury and asked about common symptoms of brain injury and asked people if they had these symptoms right after ECT and if they still had them, however long it had been since they had ECT. And everybody had some of the symptoms. Some of the people had all of the symptoms. And this was both right after ECT and much, much later. And that's also referenced in the head injury paper that I gave you. And this was also presented at the first European conference on ECT in 1992. I also asked people about rehabilitation, if they felt they had been able to rehabilitate themselves or had help. And people did not have professional help. Nobody had heard about cognitive rehabilitation. people had done what they could think of to do on their own by trial and error. And of the people that felt they had been able to adjust to their cognitive deficits after ECT, people said it took them an average of 15 years. And that is very sad, because besides losing the time that's erased by the ECT, you also can lose many years just trying to figure out what hit you and trying to figure out how to live after ECT. I think I'm probably the first person who had ECT who ever went through cognitive, which is to say, brain injury rehabilitation. That was in 1990. It's not very frequently that people find out about this. So how realistic is it to expect ECT providers to refer survivors to brain injury rehabilitation? Can the effects of ECT be remediated? And what has been the experience of patients who told their doctors about memory and cognitive deficits? And here I'm going to include people who were research subjects of Dr. Sackheim and Dr. Fink, Max Fink, who is in a contest with Harold Sackheim, I think, to see who's the biggest promoter of ECT in the world. But these are known advocates of ECT, very pulled. You must have had a stroke without knowing it. And that was their explanation. Now, these are the doctors who run the continuing education classes quite frequently to tell other people how to do ECT, that tell the world what to believe about ECT. And if they don't even consider the possibility in their very own patients that ECT causes cognitive deficits, then it is not realistic to expect any other practitioners to do so. And it is not realistic to tell people to go back to their ECT provider to get rehabilitation, because that is not going to happen. It also needs to be clear on the form that what people are looking for is head injury or brain injury rehabilitation, because it's not clear. You could think it meant psychiatric rehabilitation. You could think it meant counseling. It doesn't specify that it's rehabilitation to deal with the specific adverse cognitive effects of ECT, and people do need this. And I think that it should be said, and it should be in the form. But besides brain injury rehabilitation, the kinds of things we need are our services, education, job retraining. If people lose their educations, if people lose their ability to do their job, people need to have retraining. What we tell people in the Committee for Truth in Psychiatry consent form that everybody in our organization has endorsed is that some people are able to get along okay with the memory deficits and the cognitive deficits that they have. And other people, there's another extreme where people are devastated and their work or way of life is made impossible by them, and that you cannot know going into this where you're going to fall on that spectrum, but you need to know that there is a spectrum and what can happen to you. But if we're not even admitting that ECT causes brain injury, we're not going to get brain injury rehabilitation. And I just want to say that I don't think Dr. Bregan explained head injury very well, and I know there's a lot of confusion about that. That's the reason the National Head Injury Foundation changed its name to the National Brain Injury Foundation, because people weren't even getting the fact that, you know, head injury is more than just, you know, a tap on the head. It's an actual injury to the brain. But in the paper on head injury, again, there's a explanation about the meaning of what's called mild or minor head injury, which is not to say that its effects on the person and the person's life is mild or minor, because it can be extreme. But that's what we're talking about. And it was ECT survivors who popularized that concept of minor head injury. When we were looking for help and we were reading about this and we were reading the list of symptoms, and we said, hey, that's us. And then we started to get help, because finally we saw, you know, somebody who was describing what had happened to us. So Dr. Bregan picked up on that, but we were the first persons to really, you know, realize that and to use it to explain what happened to us in ECT. I've given you a short piece from 1976, which talks about the APA ECT Task Force. And I just want to give you a little history of this, because you don't know this history. The APA ECT Task Force was organized in 1975 with one purpose, and it was to fight against regulation or legislation of ECT, just what you guys are trying to do here. The APA opposed that and formed a task force for the purpose of opposing it. And this was in the context of the very first informed consent law for ECT, which was ever that the first laws were proposed, and then the laws were passed, and laws have continued to be passed. And the earliest legislation, as I said, was aimed at protecting patients' rights. It was aimed at ensuring that people did not get their rights trampled on and did not get involuntary ECT. But from the very beginning, the APA did not see it that way. They saw it as a threat to them personally. And that was their choice to look at it that way. And you don't have to take my word for this. You can read the books and writings of Dr. Max Fink, who founded the task force. And he'll say this: we formed to organize against these laws. And he says that the purpose of the APA task force and the task force reports was to ensure that the largest number of persons consent to ECT. That's a very different goal from trying to ensure that all persons are fully informed of the risks of ECT, regardless of whether or not they sign on the dotted line. Some people might, some people won't. So these are two goals that are really not reconcilable, and the patients and the doctors have framed this issue in such a way that they will never be reconcilable. And I just want you to appreciate the irony in adapting or adopting the APA guidelines in whatever way. And I know the form has been modified from the APA form, but I've also seen suggestions about the lack of informed consent. And we want to join with you. As I say, that's been our goal for 15 years. But essentially, allowing the industry to regulate itself, history shows, hasn't worked, and it's not going to work. I'd just like to say one other thing about the monitoring. There's a lot more I'd like to say. But as far as monitoring ECT, I heard on the tape some suggestion that we're going to collect data, we're going to start using these forms, and by October we'll have data, we'll know how good the forms are. I mean, from a survivor point of view, that's impossible. Because, first of all, after you've had ECT, you're organic for a period afterwards. I don't even remember the whole year after ECT. And even NIMH has admitted that people frequently don't remember average of 2 months after ECT. So the amnesia does not resolve. The brain does not immediately, redevelop its ability to form memories. And I don't know what time frame you were looking at between the person signing the form and asking the person, how did you like the form? Which is not the kind of question that should be asked anyway. But you have to wait, because the person is not going to be sure that their memory is not coming back. The doctor said it will come back, or people think that their memory will come back. Some doctors tell people to wait, 6 months. You cannot assess how much memory loss you had after ECT until you had enough time to be out in the world and to have information and have people telling you about things that you can't know, you don't remember, until they tell you. And at the end of a year after ECT, I had assessed my own memory loss at about 2 years. And after that time, I had more information, more people telling me things, and more things coming that I did not remember. And that was an underestimate of the amount of time that I had lost due to ECT. I think you should be asking people how much memory is lost, and you can't do that till, I would say, a year after ECT. And if you ask people that, 6 weeks or a month or 3 months after ECT, you're not going to be getting a reliable answer as to what the memory loss, the extent of the memory loss would be. And I also feel like it needs to be a neutral party asking the questions of the survivors, that it can't be the department going to the survivors, or even if there's a letter being returned. I think that it has to be somebody neutral, and I think that survivors of ECT could tell you a lot about what kind of questions you need to ask. Thank you.
And there, I just need to be mindful of the time we've got. So, are you wanting to ask a question, or are you wanting to do a question where it's brief? Okay, I'm just going to,
what he knows, and that the APA has opposed reporting of ECT statistics, so we may never know.
And the final piece is about that you don't have a website, and I was wondering if you were aware that there is a website that uses your...
You need to be prepared that the memory loss is going to 100% be permanent, can be extensive, and can be disabling at a minimum. Can be, because people have a right to know, even if it may not happen to them, they have a right to know that it can happen, so they can decide.
Just a couple questions. Number one.
But I'm not going to argue with you on that you cannot compare that to the type of thing that happens with ECT.
ECT is different in that some people seem to reliably report that they have years of memory loss.
Yeah, that doesn't happen, as far as I know, with anesthesia or with chemotherapy or other processes that you talked about.
Would you be surprised if I could produce articles that would suggest that it does happen with cardiovascular surgery and with chemotherapy, permanent, non-reversible memory loss, And would that change your views of this?
That wouldn't change what has happened to people who had ECT. I don't know about those issues. That's not my field. I don't study those issues, so I'm not an expert on that. But it wouldn't change anything.
Sure. I wonder if you could address Dr. Sackheim. You seem to have a lot of problems with Dr. Sackheim's group in particular. Their recent material on memory loss and ECT, what do you think about that?
Meaning which one? Because there's a lot.
That was in May. This is the next one. It's the one where they've come up with what they feel is now the standard of how to address memory problems.
I don't think that's what it said. That's not what it was about. I have seen Dr. Harold Sackheim's memory questionnaire, and I can tell you it's almost as if it was designed not to address the kind of things that ECT survivors forget. I mean, it has a lot of questions in there about overlearned information, about your address, you know, your grandparents' names, things that people do not commonly forget. And there is also a lot of their questions about things that may not apply to many people, things that aren't relevant to many people. Again, it's his idea of what he thinks people, you know, would remember. And there's also much information where he asked people about friends and family, not only, you know, what kind of gifts did you get? What kind of gifts did you give to your friends and family kind of thing, where you can't distinguish if you're asking somebody 6 months after ECT, did the person remember that or did the family retell? Because there is retelling, which is not remembering or relearning, and it doesn't distinguish between that. So I have a lot of ideas about how to improve that form. I told him that in 1990, and he was not interested.
So your advice to the committee would be to discount the most recent article by Sackheim's group on memory loss.
I feel that Dr. Sackheim is not a credible researcher based on my experience of knowing him for many, many years and knowing people who have been his research subjects. And he's New York, I'm New York. We have many interactions, not as individuals necessarily, but as organized survivors versus him being the person who speaks for the industry. So it's not just me that has issues with him.
And again, to clarify, how many ECT treatments would you estimate that Dr. Sackheim?
Dr. Sackheim can't do any because he's a psychologist.
He only studies. He doesn't do Ulm or bill for Ulm or chart.
Oh, but Dr. Sackheim has gotten, like I said, millions of dollars. Dr. Sackheim's reputation is based on promoting ECT. If you look at where he was in 1983 compared to, you know, by 1990 at that point, he had come from nowhere to become so-called world expert that, you know, he says, and no one's contradicting him. His whole reputation, if you look at his articles, are mostly about ECT, and he's built his reputation. So it's not just direct.
That's true.
Directly receiving money. There's also professional self-interest. Thank you very much.
Now we're going to spend a couple of minutes, and that is specialists and researchers in ECT, to Duke, the American Psychiatric Association, the National Institutes for Mental Health,